Radio.
I often get requests to identify the angry men. Who are they? Well, there isn't enough time to describe all of their attributes, but here are just a few. They argue that a 12-year-old girl is grown up enough to get an abortion without parental notification, but they categorize all teenagers, including 19-year-olds, who commit violent crimes as children. They don't want to be seen as unpatriotic, but so many hope that only tragedy befalls our servicemen and women. They argue that nutty academics proselytizing hateful and repugnant remarks in college classrooms are practicing academic freedom, but students who explore politically incorrect viewpoints in term papers should be expelled. They call displays of the Cuban, North Korean, or Iranian flag as examples of tolerance, but displays of the American flag is narrow-minded jingoism and fascism. They think the taxpayers who earned their money are not entitled to it, but that it belongs to politicians and bureaucrats. They believe the Iraqi people never experienced hardship, tragedy, or suffering until after American troops arrived. They want to suspend every first grader from school who draws a stick figure holding a gun, but they claim a 17-year-old convicted of a gun crime.
I just want to sell more head coffins. You can't beat our prices. The West Oakland head coffins. For a nice oak head coffin, it's only $55. You can get two for $90. So when father and sons are dragged over to Iraq from the National Guard, hey, and you get your head blown or sawed off, you know where to come. And then you have the nerve to whine about the angry left praises the display of Cuban and Iranian flags as tolerance, but the display of American flag as jingoism. Or when that American flag is draped around another country's statues or heads of statues or people, it's not jingoism. It's occupation. You know what time it is. Slave time. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 Santa Cruz, Skid, 104.1 Berkeley, 106.7, 96.3 LUBER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, of course, Slave Revolt, radio.blogspot.com is where you'll find the slaves, and also tune in to propagandapress.org. And savagejustice.blogspot.com to find out what insurgents on the plantation are up to. Tonight, we're going to deal with the topic of the Empire's deadly shop of whores. All that, hell, a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
Believe.
Battle for Empires. It's a journey of imperial / colonialized carnage. Latin America knows this all too well, being located next door to the beast. In this ruins of empire segment called The Empire's Deadly Shock of Horrors, we're going to explore this all-American experience. First, let's start off with Greg Randon, author of the book Empire's Workshop. Now let's start off by going into the aspiration of Sam's crushing its way into Latin America. So let's see what Gradney has to say. Check this out.
It goes back centuries. I mean, since the United States has had aspirations, an expansion into Latin America. There were plans to annex Cuba and the Dominican Republic. And don't forget, we took a third of Mexico in the mid-19th century, and Florida was part of Spanish America. The United States, since its inception, had an expansionist impulse, and Latin America, for its proximity, was clearly the place to execute that expansion. Monroe Doctrine by James Monroe, the president, in 1823, when he declared Latin America off limits to European empires. It took a while before it could actually be enforced, but it's been a guiding principle, I think, in one president after another, and certainly the principle of the Monroe Doctrine could be found in the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, which seeks to kind of turn Latin America into a U.S. province, an economic province in an increasingly globalized economy.
So you have Grandin talking about how Sam had plans to annex Cuba, the Dominican Republic, took a third of Mexico, took Florida, and on and on. This is how empires work, how they expand, and how they expand at other people's sovereignty expense for land. Resource, energy. The energy could be the labor force, and it could be in the form of chattel slavery from Africa, indentured servitude from places like Europe, when Europeans were still just Europeans and had not become white yet. Or it could be in the form of energy resources like natural gas and hydrocarbons. All of these fit within the scheme and the course of empire. He talked about the 1823 Monroe Doctrine that was outlined by President then James Monroe, and how Monroe placed within the Monroe Doctrine that Latin America was off limits to Europe, and how this is similar to the Free Trade Agreement, and how this has been more or less a guiding principle of one raggedy president after another. In other words, whether they're Democrat, Republican, or whatever, Latin America to the U.S. Empire is Sam's domain. Now, we've seen other places where this same philosophy has taken place. January 23rd, 1980, the Carter Doctrine. Quote, Jimmy Carter states, "Let our position be absolutely clear. An attempt by the outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States of America, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force." In other words, when Sam set its hooves into the Persian Gulf region for resource domination, hydrocarbons, the essential energy resource for all industrialized societies, they had the same mentality and had cultivated that type of militaristic philosophy of dominating someone else's land for their own privatized interests and being willing to use any means to maintain and secure it. You basically see the overlapping political, philosophical, and military alignment based in the financial structures of the privatized hierarchical capitalist society being played out, and how these positions of empire have all the deadly consequences flow like a river of blood, as we are seeing in the development of what's taking place in Lebanon, and how this will later play out if the empire has its way in Syria and in Iran. Sam considers these regions all part of his vital interest, and as empires operate, nothing should get in the way of their vital interests, including human life and sovereignty. So, when we talk about how Latin America was turned into a province in an increasingly globalized economy, that's the whole privatization and a dollar and chainization of the planet. And genocide is what these bandits have in store for anything that gets in their way. Now here Graydon goes into the 1800s, when Sam really started to project its imperial ambitions. So let's listen in.
In the Spanish-American War, in which we annexed Puerto Rico and took over and administered Cuba and also took over the Philippines and got tied down in the counterinsurgent war in the Philippines. And I think that was the first real, from 1898, and from 1898 for the next couple of decades, we were engaged in one invasion and occupation and guerrilla war after another in Nicaragua and Panama and Haiti and Dominican Republic. But then it was in the 1980s, and that is what the book principally focuses on. It's looking at Ronald Reagan's Central American policy. If you remember, that was to support the death squad states, anti-communist states in Nicaragua, in Guatemala and El Salvador, and anti-communist insurgencies, the Contras in Nicaragua. I look at Central America as the kind of crucible, the place where all of the different constituencies that make up the modern conservative governing coalition, the coalition that stands behind George Bush, as first coming together. You have the neoconservatives, secular neoconservatives, free market neoliberals, the evangelical fundamentalists, and the militarists. It's the first place where they first came together and sought to restore the power of the imperial presidency after the setbacks of the 1970s, after getting kicked out of Southeast Asia in Vietnam in the 1970s, after Watergate, the Church Committee. Central America really was the place that Reagan gave to movement conservatives that brought him to power. He, even as he acted with moderation in other aspects in other parts of the world, negotiating with Gorbachev, for instance, and pulling out of Lebanon, he let the movement cadres, conservative cadres, run wild in Central America because it was an area of very little import. But all of those, in some ways, this is where the coalition that stands behind Bush's preemptive warfare doctrine, which led us to war in Iraq and the disaster that's now going on in the Middle East, was first tried out.
So once again, we see how the course of empire is rooted in brutality. In 1898, during the Spanish-American War, Sam, and Nexus, Puerto Rico. Now, the reason why these regions are called Latin America and under the province of then of the Spaniards is because someone sailed the ocean blue with sword and Bible in hand. So here you have an imperial component that went up and carved up what is now called Latin America, which is why these people primarily speak Spanish, and in the case of Brazil, Portuguese, because, well, some people from Portugal came and did a similar thing. You get an idea of how these things overlap. Sam's war in the Spanish-American War was not to free the already oppressed any more than his current incursions in the Persian Gulf or in Iraq in particular is for its own imperial objectives. And as I mentioned in a previous show, Abraham's Children, the sparking off of Spain was rooted in their more or less Christian revolution against the Islams that had conquered and dominated them for 800 years. So it's one imperial, ideological, hierarchical force that's welded in hierarchical, privatized power, domination, and these religions are in part of an imperial philosophy that these Abrahams know all too well and take with them. So then, in a more modern stage, Braden talks about how Ronald the Crip Reagan's death squads in Latin America and the evangelical slash militarist of the 80s have helped set the stage and development of the neocon mix that we now see ideology from an ideological standpoint playing a prominent role today. But once again, many of their roots lay in the historical past. In the 1930s, Henry Ford entered into Brazil with the idea of creating a rubber plantation system in the region. And this required a large workforce, and that workforce being conditioned to being part of the privatized, mechanized component of the captains of industry's exploitative workforce system. Now, when you're going over to other countries, oftentimes people have cultivated their own way of life and their own process of developing their particular relationship with land, with resources, etc. But when privatized forces come in, they need to break that because they're imperial forces that are there just to exploit the labor, the land, the resources. So you had Ford and Company develop various environments basically to discipline the population into being compliant drones under the privatized workforce scheme. And one of the components were Christian schools. Because if you can take away someone else's worldview, which is what alternative hierarchical religions do, They give people a different view of the world. Their version of a top-down type of orthodoxy. Their worldview often then stops being projected around their particular environment, but looks to the particular, in this case, Abrahamic world as the center of the universe. So, part of the Western Christian world, or the Islamic Mideast world, or the Hebronic Mideast world, you know, so you got people looking towards Mecca and all these places. This is a way to culturally break them, because these religions are part of an imperial component, and these captains of industry know this all too well, from the Straussians on down. Now, mixed in with all of this is basically the sword once again. It's this modern-day Christopher Columbusism. Now, they may use various terms about preemptive war and all of that, but they know that at the end of the day, they want to, in the case of Henry Ford, Americanize and Christianize, which basically means docilize the population to be square pegs within their hierarchical monetary workforce regimental regime. Now, the preemptive wars that have to take place within that construct are deeply rooted in the Latin American experience, because that's what Latin America has been going through for hundreds and hundreds of years, from all these various invasions and waves of invasions by various imperial forces. Now, since liberals and progressives and on, these types don't really want to confront the genocidal nature of the privatized imperial market scheme, they never come to an honest take or understanding that preemptive war, quote-unquote, is a time-honored imperial strategy. After all, what did Latin America do to Sam? What did Haiti do to Sam or Panama? And I'm not talking about the recent stuff. What did Brazil, Cuba, Puerto Rico do to be in next? Their existence, their resources, human and natural resources, is all that it takes for the imperial machines that are at war, constant war, with humanity, for them to draw out their gunboats. So in the same way that they use these preemptive war terms, you know, in Latin America was a narco-terrorist or communist insurgency, you know, in the case of Salvador, Guatemala. These are just terms used by the empire to justify its preemptive war, to preempt its way into the regions for domination. In the same way that they turn around and use these terms like Islamo-fascist. These are just excuses, propagandistic excuses to carry on their particular crusade. Now here Graydon outlines the crisis Sam was in the 1970s, and how these things played themselves out. So dig this.
The sense is the crisis of the 1970s was multidimensional. It was military in the sense that a poorly armed peasant insurgency in Southeast Asia defeated the world's most technologically advanced military and kicked them out of Southeast Asia. It was politically a Watergate crisis, a kind of crisis of authority, a political authority. It was economic, the economic crisis, the depression of the recession of the 1970s was one of the longest contractions since the Great Depression. But then there was also a moral crisis, is what I try to look at. And one of the things the New Right came to power is they pledged to kind of restore not just American military power in the world, but the moral justification for that power. So when you think of the Bush Doctrine, when you think of the justification, what's unique about Iraq is not just that the U.S. Invaded a country preemptively. It's the ideological justification for that is the Republicans justifying it in idealist terms. The embrace of human rights, at least rhetorically, the embrace of the notion of nation building and democratization, that we're not there just to protect our national interests, but to bring freedom to the rest of the world. And it was this kind of combination of militarism and idealism that the Republicans embraced for the first time in Central America, where it wasn't just enough to support anti-communist murderers, torturers, and rapists in Nicaragua. Reagan had to justify that support in ever more idealist terms, and hence the Contras were converted into, if you remember, the moral equivalent of the fathers. So it was that kind of what I think neoconservatives like to call hard Wilsonianism. It was that idealist, that kind of soaring rhetoric was long the property of the Democratic Party, from Wilson to Kennedy, John Kennedy. And the Republicans kind of shunned that kind of soaring rhetoric. And it wasn't until Central America that they fully embraced it. And part of it was this kind of responding to the crisis of the 1970s.
Now, while these things intensified as part of a tactic in the 1970s because of the various crises, the economic crisis. Remember, as we've gone into, like in the Dollar and Chain series, part of the economic crisis that Sam found himself in the late 60s, early 70s, has to do with the whole global privatized structure and how these things played out. Sam's empire basically came into dominant position after World War II because the various industrialized societies blew themselves up in World War II. So the European theater was demolished. This industrial base was demolished. Japan was crushed from a material industrial base standpoint. And Sam was left unscathed. And based off of this, Sam became the major producer of goods and so on and so forth. This allowed it enormous access, along with the fact that at the Bretton Woods conference, the U.S. dollar became the world currency based off of a gold standard at $35 an ounce. But, and this is also when Sam set up the IMF, World Bank, and all of these other things at this particular conference, which became part of an imperial tool apparatus, especially later on, and pulverizing the third world and keeping other countries in check. Now, as the 60s rolled on, other industrialized countries had rebuilt from the ashes of the 1940s war theater escapade. So you had other countries coming back online in Europe, in Japan, and selling goods, so they were competing in the market against the other privatized order on Sam's plantation. At the same time, Sam had been draining its resources in Vietnam. So the Vietnam War had internally exhausted much of the dollar dominance, internally and externally. So many countries were saying they were going to turn in their gold or turn in their dollars for gold at $35 an ounce, which would basically bankrupt the U.S. because the dollar was in crisis. Nixon abandoned the gold standard, and over a period of time, as we've gone into before, what was aligned out and arranged with Saudi Arabia, one of Sam's crucial allies, was the petrodollar exchange system, which locked the world into only buying petroleum with U.S. dollars. And that set the second stage of the American empire's global hegemonic dominance. So with the second phase of the American century of global capital dominance. But that was part of the crisis, though, that he was referring to. All of these things had not resolved itself, and the petrodollar exchange system had not fully came into being during, you know, right in the 70s, per se. These things were playing itself out during this crisis period, quite naturally. And this, of course, coupled with other political crises that Sam had found himself in, Watergate, so on and so forth, the crisis of authority, as Graydon mentioned, these are once again where hocus-pocusisms play a crucial role, because religions are, these hierarchical Abrahamic religions are part of an authoritarian system where you submit to authority. You submit to these ideologies, these fables, these super spaceman beings, so-called declarations, these prophets and, you know, popes and what have you and stuff. This is a way of regimenting, disciplining the society for the overall agenda of the particular states that always promote these types of hocus-pocusisms as a way of disciplining their society. At the same time, if you have a society that has been hypnotized within these mythical constructs, then you can lay claim by the various players within the states of power, attachment to these mystical belief systems, that they are on a higher moral ground and agenda. So they can carry out some of the most barbaric things on the planet, but you'll still have the various gumpified drones still attesting to the moral credence of the particular states that they live in. They may disagree with some of the policies, but since they are tied to that particular religion, which often ties itself to the particular state, think Israel, then you'll often have the various drones within that society where they may disagree with the policy. They'll still defend the particular state apparatus. So at best, it's just a reform, quote-unquote, movement. So the barbarians in cartoon government can act a fool, but since they've wrapped themselves around and splashed themselves into the feces of Islam, they can justify, and many people who are of that faith look the other way or justify some of the most atrocious things taking place against humanity at this moment. The same with Sam's plantation. From Abu Ghraib to Fallujah, to rendering, to the slave trade itself, to the destruction of the aboriginals. Many hocus-pocusized Christians don't put things into context and don't see how these religions become part of the genocidal crusade by the state. And how the propagandistic component of these religions as an imperial tool often filter into people's psyches and to various aspects of the whole state apparatus, media, etc. Now, one can argue there is a moral crisis, moral quote-unquote, but that has to do with the fabric of these hierarchical concepts, these private market constructs, these hocus-pocus ideologies that grind people into components of a disciplined belief system at the disposal of the most powerful within those societies. Now here Graydon goes into how the ghosts of Iran, Contra, are still here in the American body politics today. So let's explore this a little. Check this out.
20 years ago, in this year in November, is the breaking of the Iran-Contra story. In November of 1986, a story appeared in the press of an illegal arms deal brokered by Oliver North and the National Security Council, selling high-tech missiles to Iran and then using the money to fund the Contras in Nicaragua. Now, unlike Vietnam, and like Watergate, that story eventually evolved into a full-scale constitutional crisis. But where Watergate yielded a kind of broad consensus about the dangers of executive power, Iran-Contra kind of petered out with the end of the Cold War, U.S. victory in the Cold War, and Reagan leaving office with high popular opinion polls. And there was no real closure with Iran-Contra. And in some ways, that's because Iran-Contra continues to this day. All of George Bush's abuses of power, the wiretaps, the torture in the name of freedom, the creation of an interagency war party in order to sell an aggressive war, the manipulation of domestic public opinion, all of those things have their roots in Iran-Contra. Iran-Contra, in some ways, was the new right's first sustained attempt to rehabilitate the imperial presidency. And one of the things that it also did was that it forced the Republican Party, it forced the White House to rely on its social base, on evangelical Christians, on mercenaries, on evangelical financiers in order to support the Contras. So it taught the Republicans how to wage an aggressive foreign policy off the books and brought together all of these different currents within the new right.
So once again, what we see taking place is how these types of privatized orders are flexible and how they're able to maneuver around their so-called laws and guidelines, because their laws and guidelines are basically really designed to keep the masses in check, justify the pulverization of the masses, and give the illusion of being civilized societies, where the particular elites within those societies often catapult over these various laws and programs and stuff. And when they facilitate enough power and resources, they often just crush right through them, especially in degenerate stages like things have come into now, where Boy George and company are just pulverizing the laws outrightly, you know, spying and all of this type of stuff, knowing that the corporatized media system, etc., will pretty much fall in line. Now, part of this to me has a lot to do with the fact that the empire is in a crisis mode itself and is in a stage where the captains realize that they're in a permanent war stage and mode. So the pretext of civility has to more or less be ignored. And these various forces that are part of their privatized social-based imperial agenda come to the fore to help be buttressed out the overall agenda of empire. Now here Graydon gives a little background into the events in Guatemala in 1954, you know, the Arbenz overthrow. Let's check this out.
1954, it was the CIA, there was a democratically elected president, Jacobo Arbenz, who was carrying out kind of FDR-like New Deal reforms, land reform, banking reform, Social Security, labor reform. But it was the Cold War. It was 1950, early 1950s was the beginning of the Cold War, and the United States, the State Department, and the Pentagon had already signaled that it wasn't going to accept democracy at the expense of stability, that stability trumped democracy. And so the CIA launched its first Latin American Cold War operation. See, the agency had already overthrown Mossadegh the year before in 1953, but Guatemala really was the most extensive CIA operation to date. It drew on all facets of U.S. power, not just military and diplomatic and economic, but it used a lot of psychological destabilization programs in order to create dissent and confusion within. It was a year-long campaign within Guatemala leading up to the overthrow. And it had the effect of radicalizing a whole generation of Latin American nationalists and reformers. Che Guevara was in Guatemala at the end of that famous motorcycle diary tour in Guatemala as a socially conscious doctor administering to Guatemala's agrarian poor, rural poor, the peasantry. And he witnessed firsthand the effect of U.S. intervention. And so it was a kind of a turning point in which reformers and nationalists no longer held up the United States as a model for democracy, as they had pretty much from FDR forward. There was a lot of goodwill coming out of the good neighbor policy and the popular front policy of the Soviet Union. And the United States, throughout the 30s and 40s, was held up as a model for democracy and development. But after 1954, a whole new younger generation, such as Che and Fidel Castro, looked the United States no longer as a model but an obstacle to be overcome. And so subsequently, after the Cuban Revolution, Che would return to Guatemala rhetorically and taunt the U.S. that Cuba will not be Guatemala as a way to justify the increasing militancy of the Cuban Revolution.
So you can see the revolving situation that's always going to exist as long as these privatized institutions and empires are in existence. In 54, as Graydon noted, the CIA overthrew Arbenz. They used all forms of imperial destruction in this, military, diplomatic, psychological. In their minds, it was part of the preemptive war strategy, since Arbenz was making moves that they felt were hostile to their particular interests. Their particular interests that, according to the Jimmy Carters, the neocons, the Brzezinski grand chessboard strategists, to the Henry Fords, to the industrialists, to the hierarchical privatized order in general, cannot be tolerated. Those who go outside of the bounds of being completely spread out and raped at the mercy and interest of the powerful industrialists and marketeers, financially, military, and otherwise, they must be disciplined. Now, this radicalizes the population. So then, in turn, these populations and elements within it are demonized. So it's an endless cycle that is embedded into this fabric of brutality by these privatized institutions. As long as they're in existence, there will always be war. There will always be these preemptive wars, because imperialism and the privatized market mold that imperialism springs out of, is part of a war apparatus. Now here last, Graydon goes into the free market absolutism of the students of the shock therapy capitalist. So let's check this out.
You can connect a certain kind of free market absolutism, which first gets rolled out in Latin America. And Chile, this is stepping back a little bit, this is more in the 70s. Chile, with the United States' involvement in the overthrow of a democratically elected Salvador Allende and Pinochet's long 17-year dictatorship, the new right, or the emerging new right, which begins to celebrate the market as a kind of creative venue for society, right? There's this kind of remoralization of the market that happens among the new right. They first apply that experiment in Chile, starting in 1975 with the Chicago Boys. Chile becomes something of a mecca for the new right, who head down and they bring delegations down to see that Chilean miracle at work. And it was a complete, what was called shock therapy, complete privatization through hundreds of thousands of people out of work. Were these Chicago graduate students, Chilean graduate students who went to Chicago to study with Milton Friedman and with Friedrich Hayek and other neoclassical economists, who saw themselves as conducting a certain kind of something like a capitalist jihad. Right? They saw the New Deal writ large across the global stage with third world state developmentalism, and they saw Chile as a kind of bridgehead in which they could breach that economic model which they railed against. And in some ways, there is a direct connection, I think, between Iraq and Chile.
Now, what's interesting about some of this is that this whole aspect of what these shock therapies produce are particular forms of dictatorship, Pinochet, the Chilean shock therapy experiment, and how you often have grad students, in the case that Graydon was talking about, the Chicago grad students, who became part of this neoclass economists, and how they were part of an apparatus of helping justify, quote unquote, intellectually, really pseudo intellectually, these types of therapies, quote unquote, into these particular societies. These are just genocidal types of things. But what's interesting is that, similar to the last week's show, The Lost Souls of a Militarized Society, where I went into these various players who go into the military and become machine gunners of people they never even met. Another component of these lost souls, so to speak, are the way the apparatus develops these students, these grads, business student type, they go to graduate school and all of that. These students later become part of the practitioners of the privatized dollar and chains empire, and are in many ways similar to these lost souls who put on the combat boots. First, there's nothing really special about these grad student types concerning intelligence, because often they're not really all that intelligent. They're just very ambitious or goal-orientated. Often want to lead a certain type of lifestyle that's very, very comfortable. And in some ways, I went into this in one of the shows called The Good Negro, where I went into how this little Negro became this corporate lawyer and was all down for empire until the racism within the corporate structure bit him. Now, the reason why I mention this, and within the context of the graduate students and the lost souls of the militarists, or the ones that put on the cowboy, the G.I. Joe boots, is that they often don't really question what their participation in the imperial dollar and change order is all about. The whole petrodollar and perpetuation of that, Sam's debt, the geopolitics, the genocidal politics, and the natural way that these things have developed and are developing in a genocidal way. For them, it's just competitive business types of schemes and stuff. Competitiveness against other societies like China or Russia, or inter-corporate competitiveness. But these things have genocidal consequences. The policies that are passed by those who become part of the order and have been trained and disciplined within these little schools is not really that much different than those who are trained in the School of the Americas. You know, where they actually come out with the guns. These cats more or less come out with the pen and the computers, the memos, the outlining of financial deals, but the genocidal results are still the same. Now, in Latin America, in places like Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Venezuela, the societies have revolted against this whole neoliberal policy, this whole free trade, which is part of the structural reform of privatization of Latin American society into a reduction of privatized control at the expense of the masses of people, the destruction of the masses of people, but for the wealth of those in power. And often this is reinforced by military intervention. Now, from 1960 to 1980, the per capita income in Latin America rose 82%. Yet, since that particular time, over the last 20 plus years, with the implementation of the neoliberal imperial policy, growth has been 10% total. 11% of Latin Americans lived in dire poverty at the end of the 1960s. In 2006, it has risen to 40%. 230 million Latin Americans are living on less than $2 a day. These are the policies that these students of the neo-class economists, these students of these graduate school institutions, help implement in for empire. And these are the outcomes. And the other students, the School of the America students, help ensure that those policies stay in place. So, in 2008, coming up, the final NAFTA provision will kick in. You know, that crime bill, you know, passed back in the day. And when this kicks in, this will require the Mexican government to remove all subsidies to Mexican bean and corn producers and remove all tariffs. While at the same time, SAM will continue to subsidize its agricultural industrial base. Central America, a similar exercise will be implemented. So SAM keeps its agricultural subsidies, but demands Latin Americans to open up their particular markets. This will destitute many more Latin Americans in a similar way that India's farming system and farmers have been destituted, which is why you have all these Indian farmers in India committing suicide every day. But it doesn't matter to the students of of the School of the America. It doesn't matter to the grad students who have been indoctrinated into this Lost Souls program of imperial destruction. What matters is imperial expansion in this deadly shop of horrors. Hold on a sec.
John Negroponte in the 1980s was the U.S. ambassador to Honduras, and he oversaw the Contra War. He was also charged with covering up death squad atrocities in Honduras. And today we saw him recycled as an ambassador to Iraq, and now he presides over the combined intelligence apparatus of the U.S. Elliot Abrams was in the State Department in the 1980s. He was one of the key kind of first-generation neoconservatives who rehabilitated, who allowed the Republicans to co-opt the language of human rights. And now we find him today in the National Security Council, charged with organizing or leading the Bush's global democratic revolution. Otto Reich. Otto Reich in the 1980s was the head of the, he's a Cuban emigre, but he was the head of the Office of Public Diplomacy, which was this massive media disinformation campaign put into place in 1983, part of Iran-Contra, investigated by the Iran-Contra, the numerous inquiries into Iran-Contra, in which flooded the media with disinformation. Today, up until recently, he was in the State Department. He was the U.S. envoy to Latin America.
Americas is a school straight out of hell. In the land of the free, free education is not truly given to U.S. citizens, but at U.S. citizens' financial expense to U.S. corporate-led Latin American military henchmen, who in this capitalist-sponsored tradition have inflicted with the teachings and thereby, of course, approval, some of America's most traditional ways of life on select portions of their own population. Traditional ways of life like murder, torture, and oppression. Now in this school straight out of hell, America's hell, much of Latin America's greatest foes to human rights and justice have gotten their training from the world's greatest foe to humanity, Sam. At this School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, in the School of Assassins founded in 1946 initially in Panama, but later moved to the U.S. in 1984 for safekeeping. Legendary murderers like El Salvador's Colonel Jose Murillo Castillo is one of the SOA's products, a man cited by Salvadoran non-governmental human rights commissions for the involvement of 1,051 executions, 129 tortures, and a tradition of Islamic-based societies like Sudan and Christian-based societies like America, 8 rapes. This SOA trains 1,500 assassins a year in sniper training, combat skills, low-intensity conflicts, psychological operations, and intelligence gatherings, which they use against their own population. Bolivia, Nicaragua, under dictator Somoza, Haiti, El Salvador, and Panama's Manuel Noriega, ex-CIA asset, have all been clients of the SOA. An SOA Hall of Fame inductee is Bolivian dictator Hugo Banzer Suarez, who after coming to power in a violent bloody coup in 1971, developed the Banzer Plan, a plan to brutally suppress the tin miners and church workers working for economic and human justice. The inhumane Banzer Plan became a blueprint throughout Latin America for strategies on repressing one's own population. On March 15, 1993, the United Nations Truth Commission report came out on El Salvador. The report cited scores of Salvadorian officers for atrocities against their own population. This inspired Father Roy Bourgeois, an ex Vietnam vet, now Maranoa priest, to found the SOA Watch. When the SOA Watch compared the UN Truth Commission findings with a list of SOA grads obtained from the National Security Archives, they found that soldiers that received the most U.S. training were involved in the worst human rights atrocities. For instance, of the three officers cited in the March 24, 1980 Archbishop Oscar Romero assassination, the well-loved champion of the poor, two were SOA grads. In the 1981 El Mazoto remote village massacre, where 800 unarmed men, women, and children were killed, 10 of the 12 officers cited were SOA grads. In the Sheridan Hotel murders of the three labor rights activists by the Salvadorian National Guardsmen, all three officers graduated from, you know where. And in the November 16, 1989 brutal murders of the six unarmed Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her teenage daughter, 19 of the 27 officers came right out of this school from hell. It's been on the heels of this injustice that Father Roy Bourgeois staged a nonviolent protest of the Jesuit priest murders that got him shipped off to spend a six-month vacation at the federal prison in Atlanta. Along with Father Bourgeois, 12 other persons, including a 74-year-old nun, a World War II vet, a member of the clergy, and a mother of eight, have all been sent off to prison for their nonviolent action commemorating the Jesuit and two female deaths. Yet none of these students from this school straight out of hell has spent any time in jail. 74% of the officers cited in the UN Truth Commission were trained at the SOA. Training manuals from the SOA were released after the courageous struggle by Jennifer Harberry, who was trying to find out the truth behind her Guatemalan guerrilla fighter husband's murder, a brutal murder that the U.S. government lied about not knowing anything about, and were willing to let her die from a self-imposed hunger strategy and strike. The Intelligence Oversight Board found that not only was the CIA involved in Harberry's husband's death, but the CIA helped train and gave assistance to the School of the Assassins grads. Concerning the manual, the Oversight Board revealed from the SOA that the school, quote, condoned practices such as execution of guerrillas, extortion, physical abuse, torture, etc., unquote. So in other words, a U.S. government school straight out of hell teaches the art of torture and to its students, and thanks to this great Christian nation, a clear connection be drawn to the atrocities that have been happening in Latin America and where these techniques, as Father Roy Bourgeois explains, exactly where they are learned.
Whenever there is a human rights report that's able to get out of Latin America, we can be sure of one thing, that those responsible for that human rights abuse, for that massacre, for that atrocity, we can be sure that they receive training at the U.S. Army School of the Americas. I want to say one very important point also, that this school is not only costly in human lives and suffering, while we are cutting budgets to schools for our children, this School of the Americas, training hundreds of soldiers from Latin America in combat skills, that's taking millions of dollars from the taxpayer. Every dollar, I want to clarify, comes from the U.S. taxpayer. And I just want to say, I think this is shameful. This is outrageous, and I feel it's time that more and more people, that we break our silence, and we let our new Congress know exactly how we feel about this issue.
So these degenerates in the U.S. government siphon off the money from the U.S. working class to fund their Nazi-like school of death, to organize Latin American Gestapo military henchmen to suppress their own Latin American population. The reason for this goes back to some of America's corporate ways of life. Domination of the working class masses, domination of the environment, domination of the peasantry, domination of the culture, and the social-economic way of life for the capitalist exploitation. So it's no coincidence that there are 500,000 young women making export goods for U.S. corporations in Central America and the Caribbean. Young women working for Walmart in Honduras between the ages of 13 and 18 years old are forced to work 13 and 14 hour shifts Monday through Friday and 23 hours straight through the night on Saturdays. To keep them awake during this madness, the employers played loud music, yelled at them, and at one time gave the exploited child laborers white pills that were probably amphetamines until they kept going into convulsions, which kinds of slows down productivity. the workers never heard of the corporate code of conduct, signed by but ignored by the U.S. corporations, that specifies an agreement to no forced child labor, workers' rights to organize, and a right to decent working conditions. Yet the young exploited workers say that the conduct that these corporations that they work for are encoded with is the screwdriver in the sun, and where if you do something that the U.S. corporations and their representatives don't like trying to organize workers for a decent life, you get bashed with the screwdriver and thrown out the stand in the hot sun. When Charlie Kernaghan from the National Labor Committee, posing as an environmentally conscious company looking to do work in places like Honduras and El Salvador, arrived at a company called Beth Forms, a women's undergarment shop in Honduras, they talked to the owner about possible labor problems, you know, things like minimum wage, social security, and environmental regulations being pushed through if the workers organize in their own interests. The owner bragged about having no labor problems and that the 400 young women they have working for them are, quote, docile, unquote, meaning beat down, and that they have a computerized blacklist so no troublemakers can get in, troublemakers like pro-union workers. When a woman did slip through and was seen passing out leaflets for workers' rights, they quickly tossed her out. These stories of suppressing workers' rights were heard over and over again, and when Kernaghan, still undercover as a business person looking for Latins to exploit, talked to John Sullivan, the highest U.S. private sector governmental official, he said this to a hidden camera and recorder.
Well, we want your business here in El Salvador. He leans over and goes like this. He says, 40 cents an hour, that's a world-class wage. He says, you're going to make a lot of money here. But don't keep the money hourly rate. He said, put him on a piece rate and speed him up. You're going to make a lot more money. Then he goes on. We asked him about the labor problems. He says, labor problems? He says, there's a computerized blacklist. Let me tell you how it operates. This is the head of the U.S. government. He says, they got a list. You want 500 workers. He says, guaranteed 1,000 are going to show up. And his own management has the list. They will compare the list with the people coming through. And they can tell you, that one's a union organizer. That one was fired 2 months ago. That one's sister's a religious fanatic. He says, you get rid of them. Don't worry about it. They run a top-notch operation. This is the sort of reality that goes behind this global economy when you try to put a human face on it.
And in tradition of never having any shame, the USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, became aware that places like Honduras, where business were booming, were running out of young women between the ages of 14 and 18 year olds to exploit. The U.S. government stepped in to pay Price Waterhouse with U.S. tax dollars a fee to perform a vegetative growth of young females versus corporate capitalist expansion. They found that the rate of young women between those ages wasn't growing fast enough. So Price Waterhouse did a survey of the vegetative growth on girls between the ages of 10 and 13. Now in Honduras, this is the same country where barbarian General Roberto Hernandez, who was tied to the Colombian drug cartels and the repression of you-know-whose class of people, is also an SOA graduate and a Hall of Fame inductee there. Another graduate from the SOA is Honduran General Carlos Garcia, a brutal dictator that ruled during 100 and 150 disappearances of Honduran people. These are the types of ties the U.S. government and its U.S. institutions of death have between these Latin military governmental oppressors, all at the behest of the U.S. corporate class and their corporations like Walmart, Levi Strauss, The Gap, JCPenney's, and Nike in the corporate class warfare against workers, in which corporations like Nike's slogan, Just Do It, is really meant for the exploiters and the Latin American SOA hitmen that help oppress the masses in the region to maintain the social economic system of oppression against the workers over there.
What this school is all about, Reed, is keeping the military in Latin America in control, in power. It is through the militaries of Latin America that we, through our foreign policy, can control the civilian population, mainly the poor, who make up the vast majority of the people there. Let me say this. There can be no hope for the poor of Latin America improving the quality of their lives until those in uniform step down. And what this school is all about is keeping the military in power And of course, what they're all about is to defend a socioeconomic system in Latin America that keeps the rich rich and the poor poor.
So it's no surprise when you look beyond the veil of capitalist deceit that where U.S. corporations receive 7% on the return of the dollar from U.S. workers, they get 14% on return from Latin American workers who are more repressed in places like Brazil. The rate on return of the dollar is 25% on direct portfolio on investment. The more oppression, the more profit in capitalism for capitalists. And in that capitalist tradition of profit over human worth, the U.S. government spends $103 million tax dollars under USAID again for an industry ad journal directed at and for U.S. and Canadian corporations claiming quality, industrialness, and reliability, with a picture of a woman by a sewing machine that states, quote, Rosa Martinez produces an apparel for U.S. markets on her sewing machine in El Salvador. You can hire her for 57 cents an hour, unquote. And workers are held kept in check for U.S. corporate exploitation by the school straight out of hell graduates like Colonel Domino Machua, who was cited for 318 tortures, 610 illegal detentions, and guess what? None of these people he tortured were corporate capitalists or human raw factory farm contractors. And if these butchers don't get enough training of murder and torture at the School of the Americas, at these SOA, these SOBs practice their savagery like two Panamanians admitted in the documentary film School of the Assassins, that homeless people became their candidates of jackbooted repression, all under the medical expertise of an Americano. All in all, the military training and armament given by the U.S. government to Latin American countries and beyond, and the building up of their armies at U.S. tax dollar expense, is used by these regimes to keep their own enemy class, the working class, poor, and peasantry population, in check. These Latin armies are not protecting their societies from outside forces. These armies are used to protect the banana republic ruling elite classes of Latin America from their own indigenous poor and working class populace, who they are helping to exploit with the U.S. ruling capitalist plunders, which is why a capitalist vulture from a New Jersey company called Avalon, a company that makes little trinket lapels, boasted, quote, we have a factory in China where we have 250 people. We own them. It's our factory, unquote. Spoken like a true capitalist criminal. What he's saying, in effect, is since we corporate capitalists own the modes of production, the organizing and planning of the structure of the society and the social economic foundation of it, and we have our SOAs, our CIAs, our DEAs, our FCCs, and our OPBs, for that matter, to protect our interests, it's our factory, or in other words, it's our world. The question is this capitalist school of exploitation that's created its own capitalist hell on planet Earth, like the one in Fort Benning, Georgia, a world you wish to live in? This has been Tracy James with a commentary. The School of the Americas is a school straight out of hell. Out.
everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
By the New York Times late in the day, as we all know. And basically because one of the reporters who had quit was going to write about it himself, so they decided to come out with it a year after the fact. But let's listen in to how this whole discussion evolved and the various techniques and strategies that Baker tried to use before he cut and ran. Check this out.
See what we're doing, and the fact that a newspaper discloses it makes it harder to win this war on terror.
And there has been an ongoing debate about all this. Should the press be allowed to report details of the program that some argue could compromise national security? Joining us from San Francisco, KGO radio talk show host Bernie Ward, and from Texas, Chris Baker, afternoon talk show host for KTRH in Houston. Thanks for being with us, guys. Bernie, let me start with you. Is this okay with the New York Times, Dick?
Well, of course it's okay. I love your intro. You said, should they be allowed? Chris, who would you like to see determine whether or not a newspaper can publish something or not?
Well, there are a lot of people who would suggest that it's national security that should make
okay,
that decision.
Okay, so who would you, so you want the government to decide what the paper can print?
What about that, Chris?
Well, first of all, national security has to come first. I read this story four times, trying to figure out exactly, all right, what information is in here for me. And basically, it smacks of, we don't like George Bush, ha ha ha, we just exposed your underwear. This is ridiculous. This is a time of war. These people are trying to kill us.
Still haven't answered my question. Who determines whether it's a national security issue or not?
Well, it's kind of basic, you know. Or obviously,
well,
somebody with more
questions
than you.
Well, go ahead and answer the question.
Instead of
taking shots, answer the question.
Excuse me, Toots, calm down. Listen.
Calm down, you won't answer the question.
This is national security.
And
we
who determines
war.
That?
This is not 24. There's no Kiefer Sutherland.
This is a war.
You're trying to spy on terrorists. You're trying to track money that terrorists and other terrorists to kill us. Now,
when the New York Times looked at that, because when they originally published this story, there was a long letter from the editor explaining how they had talked to the government, that they gave this serious consideration. They didn't see where this compromised national security. You don't think that they did that properly?
If the administration says, would you please not run this story because it compromises national security, since they're in the national security business, not the gotcha business, I would take their word for it.
I love it. They're going to take their word for it. Like, we take their word for the fact that when they find out later on that they're actually spying on Americans without any subpoena, without any judicial oversight, etc.
That's a great buzzword, Bernie, and a great way to convert from the question
matter
is, at hand.
The answer to the question, Chris, is you want the government to be able to say that something is matters national security, and then you want the government to be able to tell a newspaper that it can't publish it. You don't have a mouth to put them in. You just said you want the government to determine what's national security, and then the government should determine whether the New York Times...
Why don't you just surrender?
Just
Chris,
surrender.
Simple.
Do you want
Go
the government
ahead.
To be able to tell newspapers what to do or not?
Well, let me ask you this.
I
then.
Want
should...
responsible newspaper people to
You didn't answer the question.
Should,
I am
should Bernie,
the
maybe
decision.
The courts I'm look asking. At this? Should the courts
you
look
know,
at this?
Of course the courts should look
King,
at this.
If Peter King saying, well,
like
maybe Alberto Gonzalez, excuse me for a minute, Alberto Gonzalez has been called on by a Republican, Peter King, the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee of the House. He says he should investigate whether or not this is treason. Should there be some sort of investigation to settle this issue once and for all, Bernie?
Well, first of all, there's no war. You can't have war on a tactic, even though Chris would like to say so. You can't have war on a tactic. Secondly, these guys have already trashed the Fourth Amendment twice, and we didn't know about it for 5 years. It was only because the media got involved that we know about it at all.
Oh,
and third, I love Chris's position. His position is since the government determines national security, the government then tells the newspapers whether they can publish it or not. Absolutely.
You
tell me where I'm wrong on that, Chris.
Words out of context.
Well, then you explain to me where I'm wrong. You want them
to shut up for 2 seconds.
Hey, Chris, did you want them to tell the New York Times not to publish?
Okay, Chris, go ahead. Answer him.
I'm trying to have a conversation, a dialogue here. We're supposed to all be Americans. Now, if you want to drag me in here for a mud fight, then put us in the same stinking room, okay? But for God's sake, I'm done with this. Just cut me off. I'm done with this jackass.
Well, I'm glad because you know what, Chris? He's done with it because he hasn't answered the question, which is real simple. Who determines what a newspaper publishes? The First Amendment or the government? The bottom line is we know more now about what the government is doing to us without a court, without a warrant, without a subpoena than we've known because of Congress. And the American people ought to be very concerned about their Fourth Amendment rights and whether they're being protected. And Chris and others like him would like the government to be the one that says, okay, you can publish this, but you can't publish that.
Right,
do I have to remind everybody about the Pentagon Papers?
So you can see what happened. And on TV, in the end, when Baker says, oh, shut up, he basically pulls off his mic and storms off the set. Now, Bernie didn't know this because Bernie doesn't turn on his own monitor when he's in these little debates with these guys because he doesn't like to look down because it looks like you're looking down while they had the camera on you. So you're looking at the person you're debating through the monitor instead of just looking right at the camera and stuff. So he didn't even know the guy cut and ran. But what's interesting is that every little trick that you can think of that this little right winger tried to pull. In other words, first he tried he pulled out the you're out of control card. So he says, excuse me, Toots, calm down. Then he tried the you live in make-believe land card. He pulled that one out when he said, this is not 24, it's not Kiefer Sutherland. Then he pulled out the fat card on Ward, who's kind of plump, and said, I got one chin. Jesus Christ, man, what do you expect? Now, what's interesting, it later came out that Baker himself had a chin job. So here he is trying to clown about someone's weight, And here, he's up there running to the plastic surgeon his own damn self. Then he tried to play the coward card. You know, just surrender. Just surrender. You know, so every type of card that you can imagine. He even pulled out the responsibility card when he started getting slapped around. Or when he wanted to contain the already disciplined corporate media. But these guys, you know, never stopped pushing for more disciplining. So he whined out that I want the newspapers, that is, to be responsible. I want responsible newspapers. So the responsibility card, you know, was played. Then he tried the shame card when he said on air, overlapping what Bernie and the other woman were saying, that to talk like a clown like this on national TV, shame on all of you. So that was a shame on the corporate media card. So to pretend that, see, these clowns don't want any real debate at all. The parameters that they want is basically to be no variation of their particular worldview. Now, it's not like Bernie is really arguing for a whole alternative system or anything like that. He's still within the whole framework of the orthodoxy. He's just from a more liberalized position. But it's still within the dollar and chains order. But for reactionary glass jaw bullies like Chris Baker, that's even too much. And throwing out the shame on the corporate media car is a way of putting that out there so that when glass jaws like him come, he doesn't even have to even go through a pretense of any kind of real debate. Then he pulled out the American nationalistic card when he said, we're supposed to be all Americans. So, so every kind of card you can imagine, this clown was desperately throwing out. He even threw out the threat card in the end, where he said, if you're going to drag me in for a mud fight, put me in the same stinking room. So everything you can imagine he was trying to do, except address the issue where basically his hypocrisy was being exposed, where these right-wingers like to pretend that they're for less government. Yet, he himself admitted that since the government is quote-unquote into the national security business, he would take their word for it when he's talking about when they claim something should be held under wraps. In other words, the government should have the first and final word, and all other federations should just comply with that. Never mind oversight, never mind anything. So it kind of exposes the fallacy of the so-called conservative, you know, lesser government, quote-unquote, position. So when Bernie just was pressing him on that and wouldn't go for all of these, you know, little sidetrack games that he was trying to play, you know, the fat card, the coward card, just surrender, you know, all of that type of stuff, then guess what? Chris Baker cuts and runs. He runs off the set like a little punk, like a little coward, like a little glass jaw bully that he is, just exposing himself. Now, later that night, Bernie on his talk show talked about this whole episode, and you know, he's all happy and everything. Then Rick, a caller who's involved with the blog Daily Coast, calls in and talks to him about the debate. So let's explore this and take it at the next angle and the next level of discussion. So let's listen in. Check this out.
Rick in Los Angeles. Welcome to KGL with Bernie Ward.
How you doing, Bernie?
I'm good, Rick.
Good. I'm one of those guys that does a lot of stuff on the internet, and there's a website called Daily Coast. It's a big...
Oh, sure, absolutely.
I posted a diary about what you did, a story on the on the interview you had. And just people went really crazy about this, because this is how we expect the Democrats and progressives to be on TV all the time.
Absolutely.
Right? Because if you think about it, last year, what was the question that the Republicans were running from? What noble cause?
Did my son die for? Absolutely.
Right. And, we have the truth on our side. If we, we need to own our question.
Absolutely. I'm going crazy. I mean, I am very flattered that people, I've got emails and people say to me, why can't the Democrats talk like that? And why can't we have more of that? And I haven't got an answer for them because number one, I'm very proud of when I say something, I've got the facts to back myself up with. And then secondly, as simple a question as I asked that guy today, who should tell the New York Times what to publish? And of course, he was screwed. Because he had set it a criteria that meant the government should do it. And then he's supposed to be a right-wing conservative, which is supposed to be for less government.
He looked kind of familiar. Was that Jeff Gannon?
That was Guckert. It was Guckert. That's who that, But I didn't have a...
Toots. I didn't know...
I didn't know where Toots came from, but I didn't have a monitor. So when he had left, I had no idea that he'd left.
But man, that was I've done radio before, and I've studied people in like LA radio, like Michael Jackson and stuff.
Yeah,
that was a gold star moment, man. That was amazing. And if there are other talk show hosts and other people that can just do that, just stay on message.
Well, it's hard because
in the minds of people.
Right, it's hard because they want to ask you the when did you stop beating your wife question. And what you have to do is ignore that question and continue to answer what you want to answer. And that's the strategy I adopted years ago, was I'm going to answer the question or talk about what I want to talk about. And I don't care if you ask me when did you stop beating your wife. I'm going to ignore your question and I'm going to keep on going. O'Reilly's famous for asking you that question, Hannity also. And if you answer it, they've got you. So what you have to do is you have to stay on message and you have to come right back at them.
Mm-hmm. And I thought what was amazing too, and this maybe this is one reason why this doesn't happen that much, was that the reporter said, okay, Chris, go ahead, answer.
Yes.
Right? How many times does that actually happen? Like, Tim Russert will ask a follow-up question, or that pertains to the first question he asked.
Well, it doesn't happen very much, and that's one of the reasons I did what I did today, because I was not going to let this thing go without getting that question answered, because that seemed to me to be the most important question. And I knew most Americans, if they were asked that question, would say that they don't want the government telling the New York Times what to publish.
Right.
And this guy's supposed to be a conservative. He should also have the same position, but he was screwed. He had set himself up, and he had nowhere to go.
Yep.
I appreciate you. I'm going to have to go find the Daily Kos and take a look.
No problem.
Now, what's interesting about that conversation is how, Rick talked about how this is how we expect the Democrats and the progressives to act all of the time. And, Bernie, of course, agreed with him and stuff. And what they're basically arguing is that the Democrats and progressives need to be more aggressive in these debates. But within those parameters of what they're talking about, the stay-on-message cue and all of that type of stuff, the message is still within the parameters of staying within the confines of the privatized order. So basically, they're outlining a way for progressives and liberals, Democrats, to be more assertive and possibly gain more of an adherence within the population. But it's still within the confines that the system works. That the privatized hierarchical system is something that the masses can navigate their way through to solve the dollar and change global crisis that we're in. So within those parameters of these of the conversation, we'll get another element of how
these types of debates, at the end of the day, are formatted between liberals, progressives, Democrats, Republicans, etc. They're still formatted to keep the masses in chains, within the box, to keep them locked into thinking within a certain range frequency that, for the slaves of the world, still means genocidal death. So when they talk about we have the truth on our side, you know, what noble cause did our soldiers die for? The reality is that no soldier for any imperial machine truly dies for any noble humanistic cause. They are dying for empire. They are dying for despotic regimes. They are dying to maintain privatized existing orders. That's what they're dying for. They're dying for the elite. So there's no nobility in it. They're not dying for the slaves' cause. They're drones on the global plantation for the machine. So when they talk about we have truth on our side, quote unquote, they can point out certain contradictions within the system. But as long as it stays within pointing out the contradictions, but not driving forth the reality and pushing forth the destruction of the state apparatus, then it's just plantation politics. It's porch monkey politics. Because at the end of the day, when all the sniping and all that goes back and forth is done, it's still, you're still on the plantation of the oppressor. Crime Bill Clinton helped parlay into being this global calamity that we see taking place today. From the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act to the sanctions being sustained to the no-fly zone arena, to the aspects of having the CIA infiltrate into the inspection team with the mandate to set up the assassination of Saddam. They just handed the baton. And it has nothing to do with the fact that one's a raggedy Democrat as opposed to a raggedy Republican. It has to do with the fact that they are administrators for empire. Empires are forged by war. Empires are maintained by war. And if the world is going to be a world worth inheriting, the slaves are going to have to end these hierarchical privatized state apparatuses of death through conflict, attrition, and a war of the slaves in revolt against these oppressors on our own terms. That's the real world. Hold on a sec. Have to do wrap up these savages of the Imperial Order, the students of death in all of their forms, who graduate into an imperial apparatus of destruction for the masses. Until the next time.